Thank you very much. I will tell about some aspects of finite temperature DS-CFT, and this is work done in collaboration with Giuseppe Policastro, who is a postdoc in Cambridge, UK, Dem Song, who's a professor at INC in Seattle, and also two graduate students, Alvar Nunez, he's a graduate student at NYU, and Pavel Kovtun, he's a graduate student at University of Washington in Seattle. Here's the plan of the talk. So after some introduction and motivation, we'll talk about the simplest finite temperature model in ADS-CFT, which is of course n equals 4 supersonic mills at finite temperature in R4, I have to emphasize. And we will talk about some evidence of validity of the correspondence itself at finite temperature, because at finite temperature, of course, there are no non-randomization theorems, and you can wonder if the calculation which you are doing in gravity actually have something to do with what is happening in supersymmetric Young Mills theory. And it seems that there is a regime in the theory, the so-called hydrodynamic regime, then you can actually predict something on the field theory side of the correspondence, and then you do the computation in gravity, and you observe that the number which you predicted from the field theory considerations exactly matches the one you find in gravity. So that, I think, is a non-trivial check of ADS-CFT for non-supersymmetric case. Then we'll try to move beyond hydrodynamic approximation. We'll make connection with so-called quasi-normal frequencies, and we'll see that at least in some special cases, we can prove that quasi-normal frequencies appear as the poles of retarded correlators in the ADS-CFT correspondence, exactly. There is a suspicion that this is a general property, that whenever you are computing quasi-normal frequency, at least for asymptotical ADS background, you are actually computing the poles of retarded correlators for some operators which couple to this particular perturbation in the gravity background. All right, and so we will see that we will compute the dispersion relation, namely the dependence of the frequency on the spatial momentum for what we think are quasi-particle excitations in hot supersymmetric plasma. Now, we go back to hydrodynamics and repeat this type of calculations for other brains. I would like to say that Chris Herzog repeated the hydrodynamic calculation for the case of M2 and M5 brains, and he found that the quasi-normal frequencies or the poles of the corresponding retarded correlators have the same meaning, the same interpretation as they had in a four-dimensional CFT. Namely, he found a sound pole, and he found also diffusion poles. And that was the case in the case of M2 and M5 brain for M theory, about which we cannot really say that much. But it turns out that the same type of frequencies, of hydro frequencies, appear in other gravitational backgrounds. And we have reason to believe that this is some sort of more general, more universal feature than just one appearing in the ADS-CFT case for in four dimensions. All right, then I will try to convince you that this calculation has also some interest for people who are doing all sorts of models trying to interpret the data on which come from RIC, which is relativistic heavy ion collider. Then you collide the, for example, the gold, the ions of gold, heavy ions. There is a suspicion that quark gluon plasma forms in such collisions. And of course, it is necessary to know certain quantities in the non-perturbative regime of Young-Mills theory, such as transport coefficients, for example, viscosity. And the only source of such information comes from the ADS-CFT correspondence at the moment. So we'll try to see how elliptic flows can be not interpreted, but at least look at from a point of view of ADS-CFT. And then, the most important thing I would like to talk about is our conjecture. We hope that there exists a universal bound on the ratio of viscosity to entropy density, And the hint for this universal bound comes from the calculation of quasi-normal modes, and in particular for this calculation for DP brains. But we conjecture that this bound actually holds for all substances in nature, and we'll see how we can probably check this, at least by collecting some data from condensed matter physics. Well, eventually it will be Kelvin times second, but I will show you later. Then I will talk about the so-called membrane paradigm and its possible connection to our calculation in ADS-CF team, because our ultimate goal would be to extend these calculations of transport coefficients, in particular viscosity, to other gravitational backgrounds. Because ultimately, if we ever construct some gravitational background or string theory background, which will be dual to QCD or more, just let's say, more realistic theory than N equals 4 Super and Mills, there is very little hope that we'll be able to compute analytically things like, let's say, correlation functions. And of course, we would like to have some methods which can achieve the task of extracting information which we need, for example, the poles and the say values for viscosity and other coefficients, without actually doing this calculation. So in particular, I hope to talk about a recent paper by Buchel and Liu, who constructed a finite temperature generalization of Pilch-Werner flow. And we will see how transport coefficients can be computed in this model without actually computing the correlation functions. So that's the plan. Now, let me say a few words about motivation. So we'd like to understand strongly coupled gauge theories at non-zero temperature and density. And this, as I said already, has something to do with interpreting data from RIC. Now, lattice is of limited help because we can compute thermodynamic quantities, for example, free energy. And it was done a long time ago that people suspected confining phase transition from lattice calculation happening at particular temperature. But there is no hope to compute kinetics from lattice because for lattice calculation, you must have a measure which is e to the minus s, right, the Euclidean one. When you go to Minkowski space and you want to work with quantities which do depend on real time, for example, if you want to solve Boltzmann equation, for example, there is no hope to do this on the lattice, as far as I know. So that's the reason why, until recently, no non-perturbative information about transport coefficients, such as viscosity, was available, and ADS-CFT provides this information. So let's see how it happens. Unfortunately, even the simplest finite temperature ADS-CFT background, which is the near-extremal black free brain, dual to N equals 4 Super and Mills, is very difficult to treat analytically. Because ultimately, it gives you, if you want to compute the correlation function, for example, even the two-point function, you have to deal with the so-called Hoyne differential equation, which has no known generic solutions. And you have to resort to some sort of approximation scheme. All right? And another motivation, as I mentioned, was to check the correspondence itself at non-zero temperature. All right, so let me remind you what is the near extremal black brain background. So there is an exact solution of type 2b low energy equations of motion, and you, as usual in the DS-CFT, you take the near horizon limit of this geometry with little r, which is the radial coordinate, much less than capital R, which plays the role of the ADS radius, and this automatically gives you the limit of R naught, which is the parameter of non-extremality entering the background, much less than capital R. So this is called the near extremal limit of the black free brain. And if you compute the curvature invariance, you discover that for large Hooft coupling, the curvature invariance are still okay, so classical gravity is valid, just like in the case of pure ADS. And therefore, you interpret this background as the gravity dual of N equals 4 at temperature T, which is the same as Hawking temperature for this metric, which is in this near horizon limit is given by R naught over pi R squared. So I would like to, just to avoid confusion, I would like to say that this is not quite the same situation as was described by Witten in his well-known paper. Where he considered the Hawking page phase transition as the confining, deconfining phase transition for n equals 4 Young Mills. The difference is that this has to do with the compact, the Young Mills, with the super Young Mills on the free sphere. And there is another parameter of the radius of the sphere of compact dimension which enters the game. So we have two parameters, temperature and this radius. And of course, the ratio tells you in what phase you're sitting. So from a point of view, from this Witten's point of view, if you want, we are always sitting in the high temperature phase when we are dealing with the black brain. So you can actually find a transformation just coordinate transformation which takes you from the high temperature phase here to this type of metric. All right, so that's just to remind you. Now, so we would like to compute the correlators, but unfortunately, we can only work in a certain limit. So naturally, there are two parameters. Since the Lorentz invariance is broken by finite temperature, we naturally have two parameters, which is the ratio of the frequency to temperature and the ratio of spatial momentum to temperature. And if you take these parameters to be small, this corresponds to the hydrodynamic approximation, the large wavelength limit of your theory. In this approximation, we can compute nearly everything, and we can use the prescription for computing the Lorentzian ADS-CFT correlators, which in the ad hoc form was formulated in this paper by Son and myself, and later put on the firm ground by Chris Herzog and Son in this paper, which relates this gravity calculation to the Schwinger-Kelvish formalism of real-time finite temperature field theory. All right, so that I will not really discuss it much. What exactly you have to do here and assume that this can be discussed later or looked at in the papers. So we expect from the field theory in the hydrodynamic approximation that functional form of the correlators is fixed by conservation laws. So for example, you expect if you take, for example, correlator of stress energy tensor, you expect to find the diffusive and sound wave poles in your correlators computed from gravity. And you can also think that actually what you really want to compute is not the correlators themselves, but rather the poles, because they give you a dispersion relation for whatever excitations you have in your theory. So you really want to compute the dependence of omega on Q. All right, so let's see in the example how this works. If I look in the in Landau and Lifshitz, volume 6, this is hydrodynamics, I will see the following set of equations for the stress-energy tensor, which is basically conservation law, plus the so-called definition of T, if you want, so-called constitutive relations for the stress-energy tensor, where you have epsilon, which is the energy density in the system, P is the pressure, and you have coefficients like shear viscosity eta and bulk viscosity entering here. And if you solve this, you go to momentum space, you just solve this system. I mean, you solve it, the system has a solution with determinant equal to zero as usual, and you find the eigenmodes of the system. You find that there is a shear mode, which is given by this equation, so it is proportional to Q squared, and it's purely imaginary with a coefficient which contains the shear viscosity. And you also have the sound wave pole, which of course has a speed of sound equal to, in this particular theory, because the theory is conformal, so we have epsilon equal to 3p, and the bulk viscosity equal to zero. So we have a prediction for the speed of sound, this Vs squared must be equal to 1/3. And there is also attenuation, which contains bulk viscosity again zero, but it also contains the shear viscosity, which must be the same as in the shear mode pole. All right, so this is our prediction from the basic hydrodynamics, relativistic hydrodynamics. Now, you do the calculation in gravity, and you discover exactly what you hope to discover. Namely, you have a metric fluctuation. Well, for simplicity, you can take metric fluctuation to be dependent only on the radial coordinate, on time and z, and this leaves x and y of the brain coordinates unaffected. So you can classify this metric fluctuation in terms of this O2 Riemannian symmetry. And there are three types of modes. Well, we can call them, scalar, vector, and tensor modes. And Accordingly, there are three types of correlators which you compute. And not surprisingly, these correlators do exhibit the poles which you have predicted from relativistic hydrodynamics. So there is a shear mode with the coefficient d, which of course cannot be predicted by hydrodynamics itself. It should come from microscopic theory, right? And in this case, it comes from ADSCC, from gravity calculation. So therefore, it is interpreted as something which comes from a strongly coupled regime of your theory, which was not known before, all right? So this, the value of this coefficient d gives you the value of the shear viscosity of n equals 4 Swift-Rankine Mills in the strongly coupled regime. So that's the number. Another correlator contains the sound wave pole. Here it is. And if you solve for omega, you discover that this exactly what was predicted on the previous transparency, namely, you have a sound wave with a speed of sound equal to 1 over square root of 3, exactly as it should be. Plus attenuation constant here, which again matches the value of viscosity. If you remember previous transparency, it was a formula which related the two. So that also exactly matches. So this is a good example of a check of ADS-CFT for finite temperature, right? Because you have predicted a number, the speed of sound, and here it is in gravity. Yeah.
Well, how do you know the speed of sound is not dependent on the
Petrov coupling? Well, it's this sound. I mean, the sound wave corresponds to it's a sort of it's a sort of the collective motion in the substance, right? With a long wavelength comparison to all, think of water, for example, or some gas, right? You never care about microscopic details of this theory. And you know that no matter, and you can be embedded in M theory, whatever it is, but you can still screen there. I mean, you can.
this eta that you computed will, in general, depend on the coupling.
Oh yeah, sure. Eta will be dependent on the coupling, yeah. Mm-hmm. But the speed sound, no, just remember.
So what were the inputs that went into the speed of sound? I mean, it has something to do with which theory, right? It's not independent of the theory. So it depends on the parameters.
Introduce
a new coupling constant, break n equals 4 supersymmetry, and then presumably the speed of sound would start to change if I completely change the microscopic physics.
I'm not so sure about that.
It's close to getting into conformal invariance, right? I mean, it's not strictly a symmetry. You can't derive that from symmetry, I don't believe.
No.
And somehow, as far as you know, a conformal invariant system could have any other value. I'm not sure what the exact state is.
I'm not sure myself. Yeah, it could have something to do with equation of state. Right. Yes, but the value of the actual number, I'm not sure if the actual number is fixed. Equation of state, yes, because I mean, if you have a trace of t min equal to 0, then you have epsilon equal to 3p. But then it should be the epsilon over dp, right.
Mm-hmm. On the gravity side, you have these three types of modes, mm-hmm. and the interpretation as one being sound and one being something just comes from the form of the correlator?
Yes. Yes.
Just to be precise, so the g, that last one, which is the sound one, that's the time component of the perturbation.
This is one representative. There is a group of correlators, which they correspond to this type of perturbation, right? Where and this ultimately comes from the classification of H mu with respect to O2, right? So there are so here you have diagonal elements of H mu non-zero, and
okay.
That's
and these are retarded.
Yeah, right. These are retarded correlators. Yes. So yeah, if you can also compute, let's say, advanced correlators, but it just changes the sign of frequency.
Are there also other types of sounds?
Yeah, there is something which is called supersymmetric sound. Yeah, because the theory originally was supersymmetric, right? If you compute the correlator of the supersymmetric currents, for example, Presumably, we haven't done this yet, but presumably you will have a pole which corresponds to so-called phonino, right? A supersymmetric partner to phonon. There should be a pole. It's difficult because it involves solving the Radita-Schindler equation in this rather horrible background, and so far we have technical difficulties with that. So,
is there any general expectation for what the velocity is? Is there any?
Yeah. It's I think if I'm not mistaken, I think it should be 1/3 rather than 1/√3, but I'm not sure. But it's on the same hydro grounds. It was of course predicted some time ago, but so far we were not able to technically to solve this system of Radita-Schindler equations.
I'm sorry, could I ask one more question? Yeah. So normally the way we do finite temperature on the gravity side is periodically identifying imaginary time.
In Euclid, yeah.
In
right.
Then it's hard to separate the retarded propagator from...
Exactly.
So you did this calculation not in Euclid Lorentzian?
Yes. So that was our major obstacle from the start. Because, of course, unfortunately in Euclid, you have then to analytically continue your results to Minkowski. But you cannot solve equations exactly. So, and since you know, for example, if you don't know all Matsubara frequencies exactly, then there is no hope to do the correct analytic continuation. So that's why we were stuck for a while to, we had to formulate this Minkowski space prescription of how to compute correlators in Lorentzian directly from gravity in Minkowski space rather than going through Euclid. Yeah, so that was the... Okay. Now let's try to see. So we saw a collection of poles, right, in the approximation of omega and q being very small in comparison to temperature. But now we know that in general, in finite temperature gauge theory, there is usually infinite sequence of poles in retarded correlators, which corresponds to quasi-particle excitations of the plasma. Let's say if you think about the usual plasma, and we would like to know how it works in this particular case. So we can try to move beyond the hydrodynamic approximation, right, and to see what kind of poles we will get when omega is not small in comparison to t, right? Okay. So unfortunately, this is rather difficult to do technically, again, because the equation which governs all these type of fluctuations is something which is called the Hoyne differential equation. This is one step in complexity beyond the hypergeometric equation, which has a free regular singular points. So once you have equation with free regular singular points, you know that by conformed transformation, you can always reduce it to hypergeometric case. And therefore, you have a solution. Now, Hoyne differential equation has four. And as you know, I mean, then you have four points in the complex plane, then you cannot move them at your will, right? There is one free parameter always left, and that's the source of the technical difficulty. But there is a beautiful method which I don't have time to talk about in detail, from 19th century mathematics, and it goes back to basically to work of Poincaré, which allows you to solve not the differential equation itself, but to determine the resonance frequencies of the equation, to determine values to solve the boundary value problem, if you want, this boundary value problem, which would correspond to finding the poles of the correlators rather than the correlators themselves. And this is enough for us. We just need to see what is the dependence of omega on q. So it's...
Where did this equation come from?
The Hoyne equation? Well, the Hoyne equation, so... It was studied by Karl Hoyne in 1889, and by many people afterwards. But not that much information is available about that. And unfortunately, there are particular solutions which are known, but unfortunately, generic, and it's rather difficult. Okay, so here we come to the connection with the quasi-normal modes. Now, the quasi-normal modes are fluctuations of the gravitational background which obey the incoming wave boundary condition at the horizon, and the boundary condition at spatial infinity will depend on the type of the background. So this type of activity, I think, started from the early work of Reggie and Wheeler in 1957, who actually considered just their concern was to investigate the stability of a Schwarzschild black hole. And of course, many people afterward worked on this. So if I have the let's say gravitational fluctuations of some background, like Schwarzschild, for example, background, I can effectively, with some work, I can effectively reduce the corresponding system of equations to a Schrodinger type of equation, which is written here with some redefinition of coordinate. And this effective potential, which looks roughly like this. So here we have a horizon. And if we impose the incoming wave boundary condition to the horizon, so classically horizon does not emit, future horizon does not emit anything, then the boundary condition at the spatial infinity are such that nothing is coming from the spatial infinity. So you have some sort of violent event, for example, collision of a black hole with some object, or for example, I throw a stone in a black hole, and a black hole will emit some sort of radiation until it settles into the final stage. But nothing is coming from a spatial infinity. You can imagine an observer sitting somewhere in a spatial infinity detecting these fluctuations. So these are rather natural boundary conditions in asymptotically flat space. And you can compute the spectrum of such fluctuations. In asymptotically ADS space, the situation is more complicated because you don't have this natural understanding of what is happening at the other end. You can still impose incoming wave boundary condition at the horizon. And in particular, for scalar case, for the scalar perturbation, one natural choice of boundary condition at the spatial infinity would be Dirichlet boundary condition, because in this Schrödinger equation analogy, you just have a potential which goes to infinity. So for your wave function, you better impose the Dirichlet boundary condition. Here is was done by Gary and Veronica in 1999. And then you discover the spectrum of modes in this case. Now, this can be related to the ADS-CFT in a very simple way, because I remind you that to compute the retarded correlator, you have to find so basically you proceed exactly as was originally written by Gutfried, Klebanov, and Polyakov for a computed two-point function. The only difference is that you have to impose two conditions. You have to impose the incoming wave boundary condition at the horizon, and you have to throw away the contribution coming from the horizon to your boundary action. Okay, so these are two differences with the Euclidean prescription, if you want. So, but the important point is that you have to impose incoming wave boundary condition, just like in the quasi-normal mode case. So now let's compare the two. So you have a generic solution, right, which obeying the incoming wave boundary condition at the horizon, right, and there are non-normalizable part of the solution as usual. There are two, the asymptotic comes, splits into two pieces with the indices which you know. And if you want to compute quasi-normal modes, then you impose Dirichlet boundary condition. And looking here, it means that the coefficient B must vanish, and this gives you dependence of omega on Q, right? Because this is non-normalizable mode. If you can think of delta minus being zero, for example, and delta plus being four for the minimally coupled scalar, right? And then if you impose Dirichlet boundary condition for R going to infinity, you must have B equal to zero, right? Now let's look at the computation of the correlator, of the retarded correlator. So you do this computation with Gupfer-Polyakov, Klebanov, Gupfer-Polyakov prescription plus this Minkowski addition, and you discover that the retarded correlator will be proportional to the ratio of A over B, right? So therefore, you can conclude that if here you have B equal to zero corresponding to the spectrum of quasi-normal modes, so here we are, the zeros of B are exactly the poles of your retarded correlator, and they are the quasi-normal modes of the system. Okay, and this can be checked in some other cases explicitly, for example, in BTZ case, as Danny Birmingham and Sachs and Tolodohin did a couple of years ago. All right, so what happens with our N equals 4 Young-Mills? What kind of poles do we have in the correlator, for example, of stress-energy tensor, other than the hydrodynamic pole, which we could compute analytically? There is something else. So here's a typical picture in the complex frequency plane, which shows you the poles again, computed as quasi-normal frequencies in this system. So there is a standalone pole, the hydrodynamic pole. So here is a snapshot for Q, which is actually the ratio of spatial momentum to temperature equal to 1, right? So a particular fixed value of spatial momentum. You have this distribution of poles. There is this hydrodynamic pole. I call it hydrodynamic pole because if we take now Q to be very small, this guy will travel up the imaginary axis all the way to the origin. And here it becomes exactly the hydrodynamic pole for small omega and Q. Omega is will be equal to minus I times some coefficient times Q squared. Okay, so this is if you now take Q to be very small, you can see the emergence of hydrodynamic behavior in a very simple way. So this thing just travels back to the origin.
Yeah. So these are the quasi-normal frequencies for actual metric perturbation, not the scalar.
Yes. Yeah. For one of the channels of metric perturbation. Yeah. So, and there are other frequencies, there are other poles, right? And these are very interesting because they are sort of universal. I mean, you can think of different channels in your perturbation, as Gary just asked. You can think of scalars, right? The scalars originally did not have any poles for. So if you look at the transparency, where ADS-CFT calculations were listed, right? So here we do not have any poles at all, but here we have two hydropoles. But if you compute other poles other than hydropoles, then you discover that this, and that all have this type of poles, which are not equal, I mean, for various types of perturbation, but are very close to each other in a sense. So this is kind of universal picture which you have. All right, we can have some semi-analytical, semi-numerical approximation formula for the location of these poles. So they're given by 2 pi t is a Matsubara frequency, but look, there is this shift, and delta is conformal dimension, so here is a formula for the massive scalar, and the corresponding conformal dimension delta is entering the formula. Now note that both the real and imaginary part increases with n, with number of harmonic. And this is unlike the Schwarzschild, for example, asymptotically flat case, where you have a real part going to some finite fixed limit for large n, and imaginary part going to infinity. So in ADS Schwarzschild, we have both going to infinity, and here is the approximation formula for that. Well, now we can plot, for example, the real and imaginary part of omega versus Q, right? Because we want to, in ADS-CFT, we want to interpret these as the spectrum of quasi-particle excitations, quasi-particle modes in the theory. And you can see it sort of fits to our expectations, right? We can see this, you can see this type of a plot somewhere in the textbook on plasma theory, right? And you have the dependence on frequency on momentum going in a similar way. The difference, however, is that you have also imaginary part, which is not small in this case. So if there are quasi-particle excitations, they're very, very short-lived. So that's a feature. Now, of course, I would like to say that all this is true, of course, in the, strictly speaking, the limit of infinite Hopf coupling and infinite n. And you have to take this with corresponding grain of salt. Let me just show for a moment the corresponding picture for Schwarzschild black hole, just to remind you that this is different from the ADS case, right? You can have the same frequency plane, but now the mode, the real part of the mode goes to the fixed limit with n going to infinity, and the imaginary part grows indefinitely. So the picture is quite different. I'm not sure I really understand why this difference exists. Okay, now let me go back to hydrodynamic and repeat the calculations which we did, and also Chris Hertig did for M-brains. I repeat this for generic DP brain, right? So I would like to see, so this is again ADS-CFT type calculation in the hydrodynamic approximation for small omega and small q in comparison to the corresponding temperature. All right. You can look at this table. So D3 brain M2 and M5 were known before. So here we have the diffusion constant of R charge given by this set of numbers. And here is the familiar diffusion coefficient for the stress energy correlator. All right. So you can see something interesting here. Well, first of all, we can write down the generic formula for these guys. It's just 2 over pi plus p plus 1 times pi t. But most interestingly, in most interesting way, we observe that the diffusion constant for the shear mode is the same regardless of the gravitation of the ground of dp brain, right? We don't really understand very well the world volume theory of other brains, right, other than three. And yet we see that this coefficient is universal. So this is important for one particular reason. This is important because this coefficient is essentially equal to the ratio of eta to the entropy density and divided also by temperature, right? So therefore, we learn that in all these calculations, we have the ratio of eta to s is equal to 1 over 4 pi in some units, which I specify later, okay? So why this particular fact is important? Let me go to heavy ion collision data. Now, at RIC, one quantity which is measured is the so-called elliptic flow. Now, what is elliptic flow? You have heavy ions collided, not centrally, but with some impact parameter, which is visible here. So there is this almond-shaped region, which is supposed to contain quark gluon plasma after the collision, right? So the collision plane is this one, right? So we have two of them collided. Now, after the collision, of course, you have all sorts of particles streaming out of this region, and you can put detectors somewhere here and measure, for example, the distribution of the transverse momentum, the momentum in this plane as a function of the angle phi. And you discover that there is anisotropy in this distribution. And the particular, you have a distribution of particles with respect to transverse momentum and with respect to the angle phi. And you take the second Fourier coefficient in this expansion, you can measure this quantity, and this quantity is called the elliptic flow. So that's just something which measures anisotropy in the momentum space of the distribution of the resultant particles, for example, pions. Okay. Now, this quantity has something to do with viscosity. At least it is believed that it has something to do with viscosity, the shear viscosity. So here is one of the typical plots which come from RIC data. You have this coefficient V2, the elliptic flow, versus transverse momentum. And here you have the dots which correspond to the data. And the lines here, these curves, correspond to the hydrodynamic model, which tries to describe how this quark gluon plasma actually evolves, and it's this coefficient gamma s is related to this ratio of viscosity to entropy density and temperature. So the lesson from this plot is the following: that if you consider the ideal hydrodynamic, non-viscous hydrodynamics, then you have a solid curve which goes somewhere, right? Once you turn on viscosity and you consider viscous hydrodynamic, the effect of viscosity is to lower this curve. Now, from this plot, you can see that if your viscosity is large enough, then you have a significant deviation from the data. So you can say, or at least you can probably conjecture that viscosity, or this ratio, if you want, for the actual plasma, which happens in your collisions, should not be too large. And if you do perturbation theory in finite temperature Yanomami theory, you discover this large value, or even larger than that, right? So it means that it's good to have viscosity in non-perturbative regime of a theory, which is quite small in comparison with perturbative calculation. And that's exactly what happens in ADS CFT. All right. So I hope I convinced you that this ratio, this particular quantity is of some interest to people who are trying to interpret experiment. All right. Now, I must say that these data and hydrodynamic models which appear in RIG should be taken with a caution. Let me just show you another graph. So this is the same graph as before, the same string of dots which represent the data from RIG. But this beautiful curve, which excellently fit the data, are taken from the model which has nothing to do with hydrodynamic. It's a different group which works in the same subject. I'm just saying that one should not be too enthusiastic about these results. I mean, it's not that people can claim that they actually measure viscosity at RIG. I mean, maybe, yeah. Nonetheless, it is interesting to see what this ratio could be. Now let me introduce our bold conjecture. So we saw that, we have seen that in ADS CFT calculations for n equals 4 super young meals, we know that the ratio of eta to s is equal to 1 over 4 pi. And we know that in perturbative calculations, this ratio is nothing like the constant, right? It depends on the coupling. Okay, it's larger, actually. So we also saw that for DP brains, we always get this number 1 over 4 pi, always, regardless of the world volume theory. Now, let us conjecture that this number of viscosity to entropy density has a universal lower bound for all substances in nature, okay? And this bound is given, this is 1 over 4 pi expressed in the units.
I'm confused by this. So you're proposing a lower bound on this viscosity.
Yes.
But I would have thought viscosity, whatever it is, has to do with interactions.
Yes.
And yet entropy doesn't. I mean, you can have entropy is just some density of states, even a zero coupling. So why doesn't a free theory sort of violate this?
Well, a free theory, you can think of, let's say something like gas, right? Something like I can write here. So for example, if you have, so viscosity, let's write some formula. So viscosity, just by dimensional analysis, you can say that it is proportional to the density, velocity, and the mean free path of the particle, right? So what is written here essentially is Reynolds number, right? Because it's a dimensionless quantity which is characterizes the flow, in hydrodynamics. Now, so let me rewrite this as.
Well, already from there, I guess L would go to infinity.
That's true, but then you don't have hydrodynamic and you don't have, I mean, if L is going to infinity, what you have is the ideal gas and essentially particle can go anywhere without any interaction. So you must have, what constrains you is the requirement that you should have a hydrodynamic regime, otherwise the notion of viscosity itself ceases to exist. Okay, so let me continue this for a moment. So if I write the density as density of particles times m, and then there is v and l. So here you observe the non-relativistic momentum, right? And I would like to argue that if you express this in terms of de Broglie wavelength, right? So that will be n, and instead of me, you have h or h bar or lambda and l. Now the entropy of the system will be essentially proportional to the the entropy density will be essentially proportional up to some logs, which will set number of states, will be proportional to the density of particles. So if I now divide eta by h or h bar and n, so this will be the ratio of the mean free path to the de Broglie wavelength, right? And so it seems that this type of conjecture will tell you that the mean free path better be greater than the de Broglie wavelength of your system. So I mean, it doesn't prove anything, but it tells that it's sort of natural to, well, more or less natural in the simple model to expect inequality be in this direction, with h bar in it. Okay.
What does second law say? About?
Second law?
Second law of thermodynamics.
Say about viscosity?
Yeah.
And nothing. About viscosity, nothing. Well,
isn't viscosity produces entropy?
Viscosity?
Viscosity produces entropy.
Viscosity produces entropy. Well, I mean, this viscous fluid should somehow increase. Perhaps this is so. Yeah, I don't. I mean, obviously, to say that this should be true in general for any system is a rather far-fetched claim, right? But I mean, because there is no hope to prove it for all systems. I mean, even think of water, right? It's,
what is the number for water?
Yeah, so let me go to, yeah, so once you formulate a conjecture like this, right, then you go to some tables and feverishly try to fit the data to make it. Yeah, so let me show you. So this is just an example. We checked many substances, but so these are some of them. Of course, first of all, you can think of liquid helium, right? I mean, think of this. The viscosity should be very low, and maybe it violates the bound, right? So here what we plotted. So this left-hand side of our inequality is normalized here such that this should be greater or equal to 1, okay? So our bound is here. That's 1, okay? Now, what is plotted here is essentially viscosity to entropy density ratio for helium at different pressure and for nitrogen at different pressure. But again, this is just an example. We checked many substances. And so the typical behavior of this quantity is such that it has a minimum and certain value. So there is a wide range. I mean, it changes over a wide range. You can see it up to 100,000. But generically, the feature is such that there is a minimum somewhere on this plot. But in all examples we considered, this minimum never violates a bound. It always stays above. Okay. So if you find a counterexample, please.
WD-40 commercial.
All right. So we can try to. So we are interested in this ratio for more generic gravitational backgrounds than just a D3 brain or DP brain, right? And we'll try to see if there is some connection with the so-called membrane paradigm, which was, I think, quite popular some time ago. And I just refer you to the existing book on the subject, where you can find all the references description of what exactly membrane paradigm is. So, I quote from the introduction of this book. So, the membrane paradigm regards the event horizon as a two-dimensional actual membrane which has all the properties of the real membrane, like viscosity, for example, or electric conductivity, and has finite entropy and temperature. And the interaction of the horizon with the external universe is described in terms of familiar laws of the so-called horizon fluid, which you can rewrite. So this is still general relativity, but you can rewrite equations in the near horizon area, in the near horizon limit, in such a way that the presence of the horizon would correspond to the imaginary. Of course, I mean, actually, there is nothing there. I mean, if someone crossing the horizon, he or she doesn't see any presence of any substance there. But you can rewrite equations of motion of general relativity in such a way that it would appear as if there is some substance covering the horizon, and this substance obeys certain laws, like, for example, Navier-Stokes equation. Again, this is all follows from Einstein's equation, essentially. So there is no trick here, or there is no additional input except, apart from general relativity. So we were trying to exploit this idea in the ADS, in ADS type of the ground. So let's see where it leads us. So for example, if you take the generic metric of this form, diagonal form, and following this membrane paradigm approach, we can think of the current, right? So we define the current. Let's consider some, say, Maxwell equations in this gravitational background, right? Define a current in this way, where n is the outward normal to the horizon, right? So you can imagine that the horizon actually there is a current flowing in the horizon which is conserved. You can show from Maxwell equations that this current is actually conserved, and its components are explicitly given by these expressions, all right? So one can manipulate Maxwell equations in the curved background in such a way that you can show that current defined in this way has the familiar diffusion equation, satisfied familiar diffusion equation, and this diffusion comes from the fact that you impose the incoming wave boundary condition, so therefore you sort of break this time symmetry, right? You can only go into the horizon for your wave, right? So that's why you have the diffusive mode for this current. But that's exactly what we saw as a pole in the retarded colliators in the ADS CFT. So we can think that, and you can write the generic formula for this diffusion coefficient d, which is given in terms of the coefficients in the metric, right? Provided some condition for a frequency is satisfied. And I mean, I can talk about this a bit later if there is any interest. But the point is that by resorting to this membrane paradigm approach, you can derive a formula for the diffusion coefficient, for the coefficient which before you saw in the ADS CFT type calculation, right? So far there is no connection, it seems. But now you can check this formula. You can substitute here the coefficient in the metric, which corresponds, for example, to DP brain, right? And you can see that if you do that, you reproduce exactly the results of the table which I was showing before, right?
This is for vector field.
Yeah, this is for vector field. So in the table, I had one can derive a similar formula for gravitational case. I just didn't. I didn't write it here, but.
So are you on the stretch horizon? Stretch horizon regions?
I'm sorry.
Are you on the stretch horizon?
No. R naught is the true horizon. But we have to. Yeah, the notion of stretch horizon must be introduced in this case. It sort of is forced upon us. Here there is this condition here, which you can regard. So if you think of little r as the position of a stretch horizon, so this inequality tells you that. For each omega, omega hat is the ratio of omega to temperature. So for each fixed omega hat, the position of the stretched horizon should obey this inequality. It cannot be R naught itself. It should be some distance. And this distance depends on energy, which something you can actually you can anticipate, right? Because this notion of a stretched horizon is, you know, from the observer at infinity, the black hole is sort of covered in multi-layer, stuff, which and the thickness of a layer depends on the redshift, right? So that's often what happens there. So answering Gary's question, here in the table, is it visible? Yeah, here in the table, I didn't talk about this in detail. I was talking about the poles of the stress-energy tensor correlator, but you can do the same thing with just with for example, if you consider diffusion of our charge, right? So essentially, you can think of the R current correlator instead of energy momentum tensor. And then R current correlator has a pole, which corresponds to diffusion of our current. And the diffusion constant will be given by these numbers. So this, unlike this, depend on P. And if we use this membrane paradigm approach, or at least this formula for D, so this should correspond to the string of numbers. And indeed, if you substitute the metric, you discover that these numbers are reproduced, all of them. Okay. And one can also derive a similar formula for this type of the shear mode diffusion constant in T mu nu, and you discover that for all the backgrounds, this formula gives 1 over 4 pi t. Okay. So it seems that all these calculations have this 1 over 4 pi t thing as a universal feature. All right. Now let me briefly.
So the membrane paradigm somehow is part of the Rask how to be flat black hole.
Originally,
polarization or something when you put
yes.
in the ADS
space. Well, what we do with ADS, we actually also work in a symplectically flat background. In other words, if you think about a metric, the components which we have to substitute in the formula are the components of the full D brain metric, not just the near horizon limit of it. Yeah, so that's a difference. So we do not, in this case, we do not work in a symplectically ADS space. It's asymptotically flat. So it's still, okay. So finally, it's almost my last transparency. Since we now have this generic formula for at least what we hope is the generic formula for the transport coefficients, like the diffusion constant and viscosity, we can try to apply it to some interesting cases. And one of them was recently provided for us in a paper by Butcher and Liu, who considered to find a temperature generalization of the Pilch-Werner flow, right? So they constructed the more or less explicit solution for the gravitational background of n equals 2 star supraluminal theory. And so I remind you that Pilch and Werner considered the RG flow at zero temperature. And essentially, what Butcher and Liu did, they constructed the same background with additional parameter, which is the temperature. So now we have the mass deformation of the n equals 4 supersonic mills with a parameter m, and there is another parameter, temperature, which enters the game. So therefore, we can try to use our formulas in this case and see what is the dependence. So m going to 0, m equal to 0 corresponds to the original n equals 4 supersonic mills, and then there is a small deformation. All right. So we can plug in just the metric which we found and see what it gives for, let's say, viscosity. What is the dependence of viscosity and let's say diffusion constant on this ratio of m over t? Now, this can be done only numerically, because even though the metric, as I said, it found explicitly, this word explicitly should be understood in quotes, because actually it's given by a system of equations which unfortunately could be solved numerically. But this is a well-defined procedure. I mean, you can set the the values for the error which you wanted to obey and do the calculation, right? So that's a well-defined procedure. Now, what we found is that it seems that for small ratios of m over t, this ratio of A to S, viscosity to the entropy density and temperature, does not really change. Again, does not change means in the bounds of error which we set for this numerical calculation. So for example, I can say that the change of the eta over S is no more than, let's say, 10 to the minus 6, right, something like that. So it appears that this is the invariant, which is again equal to 1 over 4 pi t. And it would be very interesting to see if what will happen to this ratio if m over t is not a small number. Of course, you expect a phase transition at some point. And Bucci and Liu did not find any, but again, this is numerical work. You have to integrate the system of Einstein's equation to actually continue this deformation up to larger values of m. So it would be interesting to see what is the dependence of, let's say, viscosity in this theory, which is more realistic than, in some sense, more realistic than n equals 4 super n males. All right, this is almost it, so let me just conclude. So we saw that there is non-trivial check of ADS CFT at finite temperature. You can predict from relativistic hydrodynamics number of poles, and one of them is sound pole with a fixed number, which is the speed of sound. And you do the calculation in gravity, and you see exactly the same picture as you expect with these numbers, which you predicted on the field theory side. And you can also observe that the correlation functions exhibit quasi-particle excitations, as in Young-Bell's plasma and strong coupling. And there is a connection of these calculations with the calculation of quasi-normal frequencies. Now, I try to emphasize the importance of the ratio of viscosity to entropy density, and we conjectured a universal bound for this quantity, which and you can entertain yourself and try to find the counterexample to this bound. Now, I try to argue that there is something in membrane paradigm which can be used if you think about this concept in the framework of quasi-normal modes, that this can be thought of as something which gives you generic formulas for transport coefficients, and I displayed at least one of these formulas, and these generic formulas hopefully can be used in the case when we have a more realistic gravity background, such as the one that's constructed by Bucci and Liu, but hopefully others as well, right? As if we ever get something which is a gravity or string theory dual to QCD, we can probably try to employ the same approach also for this type of background. Thank you.
I was curious a little more about this, the proposed bound. So did you, I may have missed it if you said, did you have a reason why you thought that all these strongly coupled systems that you examined in the gravity dual saturated this bound?
We thought about that, but...
Is it because of the n goes to infinity limits?
No, because you can also think about perturbative Young-Mills in large and limit, right? And this gives you the perturbative formula which I wrote, which depends on the coupling and which does not give you saturation. And perturbatively, this ratio is large. So it's not...
Why should these strongly coupled substances be less viscous than liquid helium?
It's not less... remember that there is a ratio.
That's why I asked about the denominator.
Yeah, there is a ratio. I don't have a good answer for you. I mean, the thought of... It seems that that the only generic feature for all substances which are close to saturation of the bound is that they are strongly coupled. So that seems to be the generic feature of the strongly coupled.
Now, in extrapolation, the perturbative thing would have the coupling go to zero, which means it flattens out.
Right.
The effective coupling never larger than one in some sense.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. So, Gary?
So, if you just took ADS and considered just a gas of gravitons in mm-hmm. ADS, and mm-hmm. I never heard about the CFT side, mm-hmm. and you just asked, what's the speed of sound in this gas of gravitons in ADS? Is that also a third?
The gas of gravitons. If you can.
Or does the speed of sound somehow? So it can't depend on where you are,
because
it's not
the homogeneous
space. I'm not sure. But if you do this, so you sort of break the symmetry.
Break the symmetry, but then... So for example, if you compute, if you forget about CFT side completely, right, this interpretation, and just compute the sort of the propagator, right, you can... I'm not sure about that. I mean, well, there are all these issues, like, for example, is this system in thermodynamic equilibrium, right? I mean, you can think it is, right? Because
it's
effectively, it's a box.
Defined.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
So it should be a well-defined question.
Yes.
It's like putting a gas in a box.
Yeah.
Temperature certain.
Yeah. So you can expect that it will equilibrate and yeah. I don't know.
If your calculation in some sense from the CFT side, the speed of 1/3 is natural from conformal invariance.
Right.
And the initial surprise is why are we getting 1/3 from this sort of ADS calculation?
From a gravity, yeah, from a gravity side. Well, it's yeah, it seems but
whether that was also happened to be the speed of ordinary gravitons, sound waves of gravity.
For gravity.
Hmm.
It's an interesting question. I don't know. And, yeah, it could be interesting to think about it. Yeah.
In the chart you showed about the diffusion constants,
yeah.
Is there any relation between the first column and the second column because of supersymmetry?
Probably not. At least, I mean, one pole is in the, one pole comes from the R currents, right? The second pole from T mu. So you might expect that there is some supersymmetry transformation which survives this finite temperature, which relates the two somehow. But we never looked at this. So maybe there is, but for us it's just completely independent, two completely independent sets of diffusion coefficients. Yeah. Might be interesting to see.
Is there another question?